Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Heart of Sports. I'm Jason Springer, joined in studio by Jeff Rutberg. Jeffrey Cohen and Ryan Strauss will join us in a minute. Back with you on 610 AM Sports ESPN Radio. Guys, the Masters last weekend, fun times, fun time of year, end of Sixers and Flyers season. Jeff, you'll be watching the playoffs, I'm sure. How's everything going?
Things are going well, and mercifully, the Sixers season is over, and for the fans, there'll be a much-needed rest.
So you can get a break from the trust of the process, right?
Yes, I hope I don't have to hear it, except I've been hearing it from you guys about how the Phillies are amassing assets.
We will make sure that that is Jeff's favorite word. We will make sure to mention that during the show. Jeffrey Cohen, how are you doing this week?
Doing great.
Doing great. Are you excited? I know you watched the Masters last weekend. We're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Watched every minute. It was awesome.
It was awesome. But before we do that, we actually have a guest in studio this week. We're joined by five-time NHL All-Star Flyers great Brian Propp. I told Brian I grew up listening to him on the radio call the games. So how are you doing today? Thank you for joining us in studio.
Yeah, Jason, I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me.
We wanted to kind of go back to where it started for you and ask, you were drafted in 79. What was it like to kind of fulfill that dream of being drafted into the NHL?
Well, it was nice because the Flyers chose me 14th in the draft. And I wanted to be a little higher, but I was happy that I wasn't, because they had a good team, good leaders like Bob Clark. And so it was, it was exciting for me just to get there.
You played in five All-Star games. You played in the Stanley Cup. You had a 15-year career. Could you ever imagine that that's what would happen in your path?
Well, I was hoping. I think in those days, like 15 years was natural for me, and but I worked on it. When we had Pat Crozier help with working out, like it helped me prolong my career for 15 years, and otherwise, we could have been finished over a little bit earlier. So, the 80s was good to me.
So even back then, conditioning was a big part of hockey?
Well, it was, especially since Bob Clark he was 30 and he needed to work out a little bit more to keep up. And so, like, that's where it started. Now, the guys work out all the time, it means money for them. So, like, they have to be careful of what they do, what they eat, drink, and how they can make things work. So it was, Pat Creasy was a key.
So when you see somebody like Jaromír Jágr still playing into his 40s, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that he doesn't have any children. and he still provokes. He does very well. I mean, look at his stats. I mean, it's pretty amazing what he's done. But he worked hard at it, and he's at practice early, and he's a mentor for all these young guys.
It is pretty amazing to watch him still play with all of that skill. What was it like for fans that only get to watch on TV to play in an All-Star game or to play in the Stanley Cup Finals, for that?
Well, you play to win, and when you get noticed to be an All-Star or to play in the Finals, to play in the Finals is very difficult. A lot of people never even played a playoff game. And so and to win even one set, it's pretty tough. And, we had good teams in the 80s where we were there every year. And as a result, we needed to win, and we beat a lot of teams that didn't expect us to be there.
I have a question regarding one of the playoff games where you got hit by Chris Chelios. Do you think that was purposeful?
Yeah, it was, because I know in that year, it was 1989. I was 9 years into my career, and I was a leading playoff performer, and Chelios hit at me from behind, and he wasn't surprised about it, and he got away with it.
Did he ever apologize to you?
Not really. No. He, and I did talk to him, maybe last year, just for a beef, a little time, but then it was too late.
Did you ever watch the hit back? Or
oh yeah, it's on YouTube all over the place. Yeah. My kids watch it, and when I talk to people, I'll let them watch it and say, hey, listen, let's be careful, you always have your head out, but you have to make sure that you're always aware of what's going on.
After I saw that, you couldn't play the rest of the year, and the Flyers didn't win the Stanley Cup that year. I was really angry because I thought that he should have been thrown out of the game for that, and at least suspended a couple more games.
Yeah, at that time, it was a little bit you got away with a few things, but. I did come back and play the series, and so I played the last game of the season where I had a goal and assist. But we lost 4-2, and that's when Hextall stuck up for me later.
It's a little bit of a different NHL these days compared to those days.
Well, it's now you watch playoff hockey and it's exciting. It's just like it is every year. Like when you're playing with the best players, it really does make a difference of how you have to handle yourself.
The talent is amazing in some of these games that they're playing. Now, the helmet didn't really do as much to protect you. Did that surprise you? You were wearing the helmet. You maybe thought you would be safer, or what do you think about the safety?
It was where I got hit. It was in the stanchion. It was like I got hit right on the left side of my head, and it got knocked out right away, and then I fell to the ice, and then I think I had a lot of blood on my helmet. So Pat Kracer was there pretty quickly. So
was there back then? Was there any discussion at all? We know that. Concussion protocols now exist. It's one of the things that we hear in football and now more in hockey, that phrase. Obviously, the concussion protocol didn't exist back then, but was there any focus from the NHL or in the minor leagues or junior leagues when you were growing up of concussion or head injuries?
Well, you get checked out every year for your physical with the doctors, and so there is a baseline test that they use. But I think in the 70s and 80s, you probably were told just play again and just suck it up. But it's getting better. I think that there are a lot of concussions that are still going on, but you just have to be aware of where you are and hope for the best.
Was it you used to hear that when somebody would get a concussion or get knocked down that it was ringing their you just had your bell rung, get back in there? Was there back then, was there any stigma that athletes had to get over in order to deal with the fact that they did have concussions, that they shouldn't come right back in a game?
Well, at that time, they didn't really understand how unsafe it was. So they you're playing for the money that you're getting, and you work as a team, and the fighters might be a little bit more prone to concussions.
What was it like to play for Ed Snyder as an owner?
It was the best. I mean, he was the best only in the lead, and he loved the family and he enjoyed the Flyers team, and we always had good leaders there. So he built it where the character made a difference. It's just like with Ron Hextall now, like he's building for the future. Unfortunately, they missed the playoffs this year, but they have a strong network of young guys.
I saw Hextall say today that the defense is going to be dependent on some of the young guys next year. They're not going to look to bring back some of those veterans that were on short-term contracts. So it looks like they're ready to start making that transition to the next generation of players coming up.
Yeah, it should be exciting for them. I know a couple of the guys had time to play more this year in the minors, and so as a result, you learn from there.
Brian, tell us what your role is as an ambassador for the Flyers.
Well, my ambassador ambassadorship for me is good because I love going to every home game. I meet the people before the game, sign autographs, take pictures, and talk with them. And then Bernie Parent and I visit the suites in the first period. And so, you know, that way we get a chance to see all the people that we know. And, you know, we tell good stories, and Bernie gives him a nice hugs. And so, like, the girls are like that. And but, you know, it's a fun thing. And it's nice that the team still has both of us working as that.
What was it like to come to Philadelphia for a guy from Saskatchewan? And here you are in the city, which embraced you, and now you've made your family here in the area.
Well, it was I was very quiet at the start. Like, I didn't say hardly anything. That's why I had leaders like Bob Clark you know, do the talking for me. And after about 5 years in the league, when Clarkie retired, like, I had more of a leadership role. But other than that, like, you know, for the first 2 years, I didn't say anything, and the writers didn't even want to ask me any questions because it was painful for them to hear me.
And then what made you take a bigger role?
Well, as you mature, you know, I was always a really good player. And when we got, you know, I was a rookie when we had the 35-game undefeated streak, and I went to the finals against the Islanders, and we lost in six games, but If we could have won the sixth game at that time, you know, it could have made a difference for my career. But and then we lost a couple of years against the Rangers in the early years, and so from that I just learned that I needed to be a better player in the playoffs. And as a result of maturing, you understand that you have to do what's the best for you and your team to make sure that you go farther.
As a show, we try and dive a little deeper into the what you learn from sports. As somebody who had to grow into becoming that leader and more vocal, any lessons that you have for our audience that you think would be good?
Yeah, I think you always take it on yourself to do better, and don't be shy. Just be outgoing and be honest. I think that's the key. If you're not honest, people will know it, and you make things up where you can be a big...
That's, I understand. Now, you've been involved in a lot of charity work you support for traumatic brain injuries. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your involvement there and some of the efforts that that you're supporting?
So I just created a guffaw t-shirt, which a lot of people know the guffaw because if I was playing there... excuse me, Howie Mandel did the show in Atlantic City, and so I carried the copied the guffaw from Howie Mandel, and so we just created a guffaw T-shirt, and I'm using Broad Street Legends as a website. That way, what they can do is they can print out the T-shirts, and then they can give me $5. A t-shirt back for traumatic brain injury people. And the charity was from Eric Toppy. He had a big car crash 6 years ago where he almost died. And as a result, you know, he wanted to give back, and it's taken him a little while just to kind of get his brain in order.
So how did you get involved? I know that he's Canadian, but it's a big country. How'd you get involved with Howie Mandel?
Well, he always did his show in Atlantic Center, and so, like, there he always said, rather than clap, cheer, and whistle, just do a thing called the guffaw, which means you can't see it, but I'm raising my hand to the right and like a salute. Uh-huh. And so I saw him at the show. And when he went to the show, he told me that, here, I'm going to do a guffaw when I start scoring in the mid-90s, 80s. And so he was okay with that. And actually, just about a month ago, I met him again in resorts with Howie Mandel. He did a show. And then so we had a good chance to talk because, you know, he's gone through a lot of things, similar things that I have. He's had two ablations. And, you know, he still needs to, you know, be careful of the blood thinners and everything else that he has going on.
You also mentioned that you were involved in, another charity called Victory.
Yeah, Victory is an athlete group out of Canada. And a lot of the top athletes are there. And so what I'm going to create another dinner when I have a bunch of athletes in town for a dinner, and just to get to know everybody. And from there, if they want to decide that they want to be a member, they can. So I'm thinking of May 25th, where I can do the dinner with Victory. And we can do a good job with that. But, you know, this is how I can help a lot of people. I do a lot on social media, and I post a lot of pictures, and I'm at a lot of different events. But it really helps all the charities that I've been future to win.
So it seems that you're involved in, even post your hockey career, post being a player, you're very involved in the community. Do you speak to current athletes or kids that are becoming athletes about their role, not just on the ice or on a field, but also the value of giving back to their community the way that you do?
Well, I think most of the hockey players grow up that way, where they understand what they need to do, and they all have PR guys. Excuse me, PR guys that can help them too. But and a lot of these hockey players have their own charities, so it makes sense for them to understand what they can do, and they give back by helping out and meeting the right people.
One of the things that I did years ago was be members of a chamber of commerce, and the Flyers were often also members, and they always came out to the different functions that we had. They were always in a jacket and tie, and they were always involved. Was that Mr. Snyder? Ed Snyder, was he a big part of that?
Oh, definitely, because he made sure that we were all there, and he made sure that everybody was there at a couple different events. So we did a couple fan dinners where a lot of the alumni or players showed up, and so that made it good for the people that were there.
Also, the Barry Ashby, they used to have a fund, was it leukemia, I think it was.
Yes.
Do they still have that? Do they still do that?
No, I think it's passed now. I mean, they used to, but now it's more the Flyers Carnival that, that I've been there for like 30 years and helping out, and so a lot of these guys are giving it here too.
So with regard to the two charities that you've mentioned here today, how can people get involved? We're going to put the information up on our website so people can go there if they want to. But if people want to find out more about these charities, where can they find that out?
Well, I would say that if people want to go to my brianprop.com website, I have a lot of information. And I ask people if they're interested in going to an appearance, that they could email me and get in contact with me. And then, I have an agent that I use too, also, that it helps.
Okay. I do have one question, though, because it was brought up by Jeff. The phrase of Mr. Snyder, did even the players refer to him as Mr. Snyder, or did people like you actually call him behind the scenes, call him Ed?
No, always Mr. Snyder. Yeah.
Interesting. We truly appreciate you coming in to talk with us today. We would love to get more information about some of the events you're involved in, and hopefully you'll come back and join us again.
Thanks, Jason.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. You're listening to The Heart of Sports on 610 AM Sports. It's time for us to take a break. When we return, we'll talk with Bill Giles about the Phillies. Stay right here.
Let me tell you, buying or selling a home is a life-changing decision. Whether you're looking for your first home or searching for your forever home, Ann Coons is the realtor you need. In fact, she helped my wife and I settle into our forever home. With over 30 years helping satisfied clients buy and sell homes in the Delaware Valley, Ann Coons will give you the professional and reliable service you deserve. When it's time to buy or sell a home in South Jersey or Philadelphia, contact Ann Coons, the only name you need to know in real estate. You can call Ann Coons today at 856-795-4709. Again, that's 856-795-4709. Or learn more on the web at www.anncoonsrealestate.com.
Are you looking for a lifeline? Verizon New Jersey Shares Communication Lifeline is a statewide nonprofit that provides assistance to individuals and families living in New Jersey, those who are in need of temporary help in paying their communication and energy bills. Want to know how to apply? All you need to do is call Verizon New Jersey Shares at 1-888-337-3339 or visit on the web at www.newjerseyshares.org. It's quick and easy to sign up, but remember, you must be a Verizon Residential Landline customer to apply for eligible programs. That's Verizon New Jersey Shares, keeping the lines of communication open for you and your family.
And we're back. This is the Heart of Sports on 610 AM Sports. I'm Jeff Rutberg with Jason Springer, Ryan Strauss, and Jeffrey Cohen.
And on the phone right now, we have our special guest. It's Bill Giles, former longtime owner of the Philadelphia Phillies and an honorary president of the National League. Bill, thanks for coming.
I'm happy to be here. I just played pretty good golf, so I'm happy.
We just talked about the we'll be talking about the golf in our next segment, talking about the Masters a little bit. So we'll make sure to get a little golf talk in for you. Hope you had a good game out there.
So Bill, we wanted to start with a little current Phillies discussion. You go to spring training every year, right?
Correct.
And were you able to get down there this year?
I was ill, and I only saw the last 2 weeks.
Okay, so from what you did see while you were down there, what did you like about what you saw about the team?
What I liked by far the most was the depth of good young players we have. Unfortunately, we didn't show it very well this weekend, but but I think we're in good shape for the next 10 years after we get through this year of experiments. To be legitimate contenders.
You mentioned the amount of depth that the team has. Are you a guy that still follows the minor leagues?
Every morning, the first thing I do when I get up is read the reports. It's not only the box scores, but they give you a summary of what each player did, whether he did good things or bad things, and I live for that moment when I read all those reports.
Now, I remember years ago when the first time that I went to spring training down in Clearwater, you had mentioned to me to travel over to the backfields behind the main stadium to check that out. And I remember how exciting it was, especially for my son and I, to go back there and see the younger players. When you go to the backfields the last couple of years, who are the guys that you look at and say these guys could be the next face of the Phillies?
Well, the player development people tell me, keep your eye on this guy, keep your eye on that guy. And so this year, I'm a big fan of Roman Quinn, and I watched him some, and Alfaro, the catcher, and Nick Williams, and Cousins, and Hoskins, and a guy named Andrew Pullen, who you've never heard much about. He's an outfielder playing with Redding, and we have some in Moniak, the kid we signed a couple of years ago, number one.
He got off to a good start.
Yeah, he did. He went 0-for-7 the other day, but Everybody tells me he's going to be a good player, so I'm excited about the future. I'm not too excited about what happened against the Mets, but
you mentioned that. So of all the teams that the Phillies play, which one bothers you the most when they lose? I think I know the answer to that, but
we really played good baseball against Washington, and we didn't make mistakes. We made a lot of good things, like a delayed steal and all those little things you do. And then the first Mets game is a game that we should have won, and we made a few mistakes. Those are the games that hurt more than getting clobbered like we did in the second game. And it's a progress, and you got to be a little worried about our pitching. I think eventually our hitting will come around, but Velasquez has the great arm and strikes people out, but he has a hard time winning games. So
Buckholz
Buckholz being hurt may be a little bit of a blessing, because we're going to bring up probably Zach Eflin or one of the kids that's pitching well.
Now, my theory is, tell me what you think. My theory is that Velasquez will ultimately end up in the bullpen with that arm, that he seems to get through that first, the first time around the lineup really well, but then after that, he seems to struggle and he throws a ton of pitches.
Yeah, I mean, even when he's getting people out, he's only a 4 or 5, maybe 6 inning pitcher because he strikes out so many people.
What has surprised you so far throughout the spring and into the early start of the season?
Well, I've been a little disappointed in a couple of our hitters. Saunders and Rupp haven't done much. And, you know, the first four guys in the lineup have been doing okay, but Rupp is not hitting as well as last year, and Saunders had a couple of good days. But I'm worried about the 5, 6, 7 holes as far as driving in runs is concerned.
What do you think of Brock Stassi's story? That's our co-host here, Jeff, his son's favorite player because they go to a lot of minor league games. What do you think about him coming up to the majors, getting his number, and hitting a homer to start his career?
Well, it's a good story. Brock has played a lot of games in the minor leagues. And Brock was my golf partner last spring, and I got to like him as a person. So I really root for him, and he's a good kid. He's got great defensive abilities, and he's got some power.
How'd the two of you do in that golf tournament?
We didn't do well.
Thinking about the division alignments in baseball, I know that that's changed the amount of times the Phillies have played teams like the Cubs or the Cardinals. Moving forward in the next 10 or however many years, do you have any opinion around how the National League should align the teams and whether or not there might be expansion?
Well, I've been very involved over the years in schedule making and alignments and everything. I kind of created the ones there now. And, you know, you have the big debate about playing an unbalanced schedule where you play teams in your own division more times than you do the Cubs and Cardinals and so forth. And I've always believed in that. I thought it really helped your attendance, particularly in September when you're competing against the teams you're trying to beat out for your division championship. So I still believe in it, although this year it looks like the Mets and Washington are stronger than the rest of the teams, although Florida might, you know, sneak in there.
It sounds like you feel pretty good about the Phillies farm system. What do you think of the job that McPhail and Klentak have done with the team?
I'm a big fan of Andy. I've known Andy for many, many years, and his father and my father were good friends. I think they're going to do a fine job. They do have a plan, and they show me and the other owners what the plan is, and we're going to suffer a little bit this year, but beginning in 2018 and for 10 or 12 years, we should have a competitive team. But you never know about young prospects. I mean, a lot of them really come on and some of them don't.
I wanted to ask you about your involvement. You come from a baseball family, and so how did you get involved in baseball from the beginning?
Well, first of all, I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player, and when I got cut from my high school team, it kind of gave me a signal that I wasn't going to make it. So I started working in the front office and doing all the odd jobs there were. I worked with the Cincinnati Reds for a while when I was going to school, and then I worked in the minor leagues for 1 year in Nashville, Tennessee, and then I started out in Houston, Texas when they first got a franchise.
And you were the traveling secretary and publicity director, right, in their inaugural season?
Yeah, I did both jobs for the whole season.
Who was the manager of those Colt 45s?
Grady Hatton and Harry Kraft.
Okay. And so how did you end up going from the Houston Colt 45s to ending up in Philadelphia?
Well, in 1965, the Colt 45s changed their name to the Astros because of the Astrodome being built and the fact that all the astronauts were in Houston. But then in after the 69 season, Mr. Carpenter, who owned the Phillies, was moving into Veterans Stadium, and I had built a reputation as a good marketing man, and they hired me to be basically their marketing guy, and I was in charge of all the promotions and ticket sales and in charge of everything but the players.
Did you
come? Paul Owens and I worked together as a kind of a tandem. I did the business and he did the players, and we started to get successful in 76 and so forth for about 10 years.
When did you start with the Phillies?
My first season was 1970.
So right before Veterans Stadium opened.
That is correct. The reason they brought me in is because they were building the Vet.
What was it like?
They had a pretty stodgy marketing plan, and I did a lot of nutty things to get people interested.
Like what? Give us a couple examples of some of the crazy things that you did.
Well, they had never had good crowds for opening day, and I grew up in Cincinnati where they always sold out. And in Philadelphia, they had 14, 15,000 people. And I said, what do you guys do for opening day? And they told me they had a Salvation Army band play the anthem. And I said, yeah, we got to do something exciting. So I had the first ball dropped in from a helicopter, and it got a lot of TV attention.
Kite Man, right? Remember that Kite Man? Was that you?
Second year. Oh, it's the great Kite Man.
So you were a marketer when you were brought in. You were there to promote the team and try and build the franchise that at that time didn't have the crowds that they were looking for?
Yeah, they only had 500,000 people for the season the year before I arrived. And by the time I was in my swing, we were drawing 3 million, so that was a big difference.
What was it like moving out of Scheib Park for the Phillies?
Connie Mack Stadium, really.
Yeah, well, Connie Mack Stadium was a good park once you're in the park and seated, but it was a little dangerous parking your car, and it was kind of falling apart, basically.
Yeah, where kids would ask to watch a car for a quarter, mister. If you didn't give them the quarter, or later it was a dollar, there were problems. Go ahead.
So, Bill, as part of the marketing part of your role, did you have anything to do with bringing in Harry Callis?
I did.
And how did that happen?
I was the one that brought him in. Well, I brought him in the second year I was there because we changed beer sponsors, and Bill Campbell had been on the air with Buy Som, and Ballantine Beer was the sponsor. Excuse my cough. There's a lot of pollen out here. And Schmidt's Beer became the big sponsor, and they said, well, we'll give you $1 million a year, but we don't want Bill Campbell because he's connected with Ballantyne. So I knew a guy in Houston who I worked with. He was the broadcaster color man in Houston. And I thought he was terrific. And so I said, okay. And then I fired Campbell and hired Harry Callis. And Callis and Ashburn became, in time, I think the greatest duo I've ever heard on television.
I think a lot of people in this town would agree. And going to the stadium now, you still see Harry Callis' statue. I know if you went to opening day, you got to hear Kane Callis do the national anthem. Now, as part of, I mean, you've been part of a very long history of the Phillies, and part of that Phillies was working with Dallas Green and Ruben Amaro Sr., who unfortunately passed away this year. Can you tell us a little bit about your fondest memories of both of these great fillies?
Well, they're two different kind of styles of personality. Reuben was a very sweet, gentle man. Dallas Green was kind of the opposite. He was a tough hombre. And, you know, his physical presence, his voice and everything, he was a tough cookie. And in 1979, we had Danny Ozark as our manager, and a lot of the good players got hurt, but we kind of didn't do as well as everybody thought because we'd brought in Pete Rose. So I recommended to Willie Carpenter and Bob that they put Dallas Green down there because Dallas Green was a tough guy, and he would make the players play up to their ability, and he did a super job in 1980. And was, you know, he was a tough cookie. He would tell them when they made mistakes, and he was, but he kept pushing and pushing, and we ended up winning the first World Series ever. So,
What made you think?
He has to be given a lot of credit for what we did.
What made you think of Dallas Green as the answer to the ills of 79?
Well, when I was making my way as director of business and, you know, vice president and all that stuff, I hung out with Dallas and Paul Owens and Hugh Alexander. And Dallas really had Philly blood in him. He loved the Phillies. He was a pitcher originally with the Phillies way back. And he wanted everybody to do it the Phillies way, and he wanted to have the game played properly by the players, and he wanted them to play as a team, not as an individual, and all that philosophy really worked.
Certainly did.
I remember Dallas Green when he played for the Phillies briefly. He wasn't very good as a player, but
he was a middle reliever and not particularly successful.
Now, if you had to, if a story that maybe people didn't know or a funny story about Dallas Green, do you have one of those?
Well, I really don't.
You're not able to tell any of them on the radio, probably.
He was always very serious and very tough. I mean, the 1980 team was kind of a funny team because the players really didn't like the manager. They didn't like Dallas because he was so tough. And the infielders didn't like the pitchers, and the pitchers didn't like the infielders. It was a kind of a mess, but we won.
Did Larry Boa get along with Dallas?
Larry Boa is one of my favorite guys. He, you know, when you look at the records of shortstops in the Hall of Fame, and you take a look at Larry Boa's record and compare it to Pee Wee Reese and Phil Rizzuto, Larry Boa had a much, much better record, both offensively and defensively. When I first saw Boa, I didn't think he would ever hit, and he got over 2,500 hits in his career. Boa, I hired him and fired him. I traded him along with Ryan Sandberg for Ivan De Jesus.
Oh, we weren't going to bring that up.
Some fans weren't
a fan of that trade.
And Ryan Sandberg went on the Hall of Fame, so that shows you how.
it's really a dice game, and you really, really don't know.
It's prospects.
It's assets. Yeah.
So Bill.
A lot of good prospects. We've traded turned out fairly well, but on the other side of the coin, we picked up a few prospects that the other club didn't really think too highly of, and yeah, they turned out well.
Yeah, especially over the last couple decades, you've done really well there.
Yeah.
You know, Bill, I wanted to just before you go, just spend a couple minutes. I've been lucky enough to see you not just as a Phillies management and a pioneer in that area. You've been involved as a community leader and a pioneer in Philadelphia with regard to some charitable work. The one that I'm familiar with is a group called Cade Kids. Can you tell us a little bit about Cade Kids and what the history of that was, how you formed that and what your thinking was?
Well, I was always, when I was running the ship, I was always a great believer in the organization and the players in particular, giving back to the community. And we had a wives function, a wives organization, that started to have charitable fashion shows and things. And I met a lady named Malverna Charleston way back in the late 70s. And she said, you know, the Phillies should really have ALS as their charity because the great Lou Gehrig died of ALS. And that made sense to me. So we became the official sponsor, or ALS became the official sponsor of us. And we worked together. There's a lady named Ellen Phillips that's just sensational. And she and my wife and many others worked together. We've now raised $17 million for ALS. But in addition to ALS, my favorite charity that we work on is an organization called CADE Kids. And that started, I don't know, 30 years ago or so, when the police chief at the time, Mr. Tucker, came to me and told me about the program, and I said, this is something we got to do something about. So we raised some money, and the Sixers and Flyers and Eagles chipped in, and it's really the best program, I think, in the country. But the problem is we haven't gotten enough money to get as many specialists. We have specialists that go into the worst schools in Philadelphia. The police department tells us where the kids are really need help. And we teach about living a good life. No alcohol, no tobacco, no fighting, going to school every day, good attendance, listening to your teacher and all that stuff. And it really works. We have statistics that show that kids that go through the CADE Kids program get better grades, they graduate from class to class, from second to third, from fourth to fifth, etc. And it works. And I've been trying for years, and Jeff used to be on the board, to get more money so we can get more specialists to teach more kids and to expand it across the country. Hopefully someday that'll happen.
Well, we will make sure to keep spreading the word here on the show, and we truly appreciate you joining us this week to have a conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
I apologize for my voice.
No worries at all. Thank you so much for your time, Bill.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to The Heart of Sports on 610 AM Sports. It's time for us to take a break, and when we return, we'll talk about Philly sports. Stay right with us.
Let me tell you, buying or selling a home is a life-changing decision. Whether you're looking for your first home or searching for your forever home, Ann Coons is the realtor you need. In fact, she helped my wife and I settle into our forever home. With over 30 years helping satisfied clients buy and sell homes in the Delaware Valley, Ann Coons will give you the professional and reliable service you deserve. When it's time to buy or sell a home in South Jersey or Philadelphia, contact Ann Coons, the only name you need to know in real estate. You can call Ann Coons today at 856-795-4709. Again, that's 856-795-4709. Or learn more on the web at www.anncoonsrealestate.com.
Are you looking for a lifeline? Verizon New Jersey Shares Communication Lifeline is a statewide nonprofit that provides assistance to individuals and families living in New Jersey, those who are in need of temporary help in paying their communication and energy bills. Want to know how to apply? All you need to do is call Verizon New Jersey Shares at 1-888-337-3339 or visit on the web at www.newjerseyshares.org. It's quick and easy to sign up, but remember, you must be a Verizon Residential Landline customer to apply for eligible programs. That's Verizon New Jersey Shares, keeping the lines of communication open for you and your family.
Go Great to be back with you on the Heart of Sports. On 610 AM Sports, I'm Jeff Rutberg, along with Jason Springer, Ryan Strauss, and Jeffrey Cohen.
Guys, last week we had a golf pro in here and we talked Masters. It did not disappoint me at all. Jeffrey Cohen, I know you were glued to the TV.
I was excited to watch it. It was an absolutely incredible finish. It wasn't from beginning to end wasn't a great tournament, but you couldn't ask for anything more than the two guys in the final group coming down to the last six holes and just battling each other. And then on top of it, these guys have been friends for 20 years. They were encouraging, not encouraging each other, but giving each other high fives when they did something right.
The wives were also speaking and hugging during it. It was a really good example of sportsmanship like we talk about on the show.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. And, you know, there are some people that will sit there and say, no, that's, you know, Tiger Woods, you know, he wouldn't talk to anybody as he came down to the finish, and that's the way you should be in competition. These guys were just as competitive as that and still were able to come. And 18 holes on the last day wasn't enough.
No, they kept going, went into extra holes. Jeff, Ryan, did you guys watch the tournament?
No, I didn't, but I do want to ask a question. How do you know, unless you really watched carefully, that nobody moved the ball an inch away from where it should have been when they put the mark down?
It's the whole honor code of golf, though.
Well, and that came up the last day. There actually was a point at which Sergio was in the pine needles. I think it was Sergio. One of them was in the pine needles, and they actually had to go to a replay. And I guarantee you millions of people were watching that going, oh, my God, here we go again.
Yeah.
And it's got to stop. It's as simple as you are playing with somebody else. That other person has a caddy. There are people walking around the course that are officials all the time. If they don't see it, enough.
And then
let it go.
Then isn't done. Yeah. If it's not seen, then it didn't happen.
Right.
Ryan, did you get some time to catch the Masters at all?
I saw a little bit. I always think that watching a major on the last day is by far when golf is the most exciting. I mean, I'm sure the other tournaments on Sunday are also nearly as exciting, but with the major and the green jacket and all the tradition, it's really entertaining to watch.
Isn't it kind of like a basketball game in the last 2 minutes?
It is. It's the time that you want to be watching, the emotion that's on the course. The course looks spectacular just from a visual on television. It just looks amazing to be able to play on it. And then we saw a hole in one, Jeff.
That was another amazing moment because Matt Kuchar, who is an American golfer, has been around for a long time. When he was a young guy, he was supposed to be one of the next Tiger Woods type players. And it really never turned out that way. He's had a really good career, but he's always been an ambassador for the game. And he showed it in a way that nobody should ever expect a professional athlete to do this. But what he did was he hit a hole in one at the Masters. Anybody who's ever played golf, the thought of playing at the Masters, let alone getting a hole in one at the Masters, and he walks over to the cup, picks his ball out of the hole, and immediately grabs a pen, signs the ball, and hands it over to a kid.
That's what you want to see out of your athletes in sports. Anything else surprise you from the 4 days at the Masters that you didn't expect?
The fact that a lot of the better players just kind of fell out of contention. I mean, Ricky Fowler is probably the most popular golfer among the 20 and younger set with the flat-brimmed hat and the bright clothes. He was in contention. He was in the second to last group and just kind of fell away. And I think it would have made it even more exciting if somebody like Fowler, because he's never won a major, and it would have been interesting to see him win a major. But it was nice to see Sergio. Sergio is, I think, the third most majors played without winning one. So it was pretty cool to see a guy who's played over 70 majors finally win one.
See, with golf, watching golf, I'll do it every once in a while, but I'd rather play. So I'll either be on a miniature golf course with my daughter, or I'll go chip and putting.
That's once in a while. That's just like Augusta.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's just as hard, right? Yeah, but it's fun. Golf can be fun, but I find it more enjoyable to play it rather than watch it on television.
Yeah, but I think you learn to appreciate it. If the more you play golf and you realize the nuances of it and how hard it is
yes.
to, I mean, you'll have four shots to get a ball in a hole that's 400 yards away, and you could knock it on the green within two, and you're only a couple feet away, and then it takes you three more shots to get it in, and you don't even get a point.
See, I find it less frustrating when I'm not the one flubbing the shots and I'm watching on TV. So as much fun as it is for me to play, I feel no pressure when I'm on my couch watching them flub their shots.
You mentioned mini golf, Jeff, and I'm a huge mini golf fan. I, for one, would watch professional mini golf if it was a thing. So maybe that's a new idea for your entrepreneurial side.
There you go, Jeff. Forget the soccer. Now move on to miniature professional mini golf.
Okay, with men and women playing together.
There you go.
Boys
there you
and
go.
Girls, yeah.
Another thing I've noticed with the Masters, though, it seems like Masters pools are becoming more and more of a thing. Was that like a popular thing to do more than 5 years ago, or has it just grown in popularity because of March Madness and we all like to have fun?
I would think that there's just an increase in every level of wagering and following the sports and trying to figure out what your angle is to be interested. It's definitely increased in popularity.
Yeah, I don't remember it even 10 years ago, but now they even have fantasy golf. I mean, if there's a way for them to make money and for people to gamble, they'll find a way to do it.
That'll drive Jeff nuts. Well, speaking of fantasy, we talked but previously on the show about fantasy football, but we've got the real thing coming to Philadelphia. We've got the draft coming here in a few weeks. They're already constructing the set along the parkway. I know that...
Yeah, I'm sure the people who go to the art museum must be thrilled.
They're probably not as excited about the draft as everybody else is. Jeff, are you reading your brochures of college football players that we can select in the seventh round?
No, I'm just looking at all the mock drafts on the internet.
So are you liking what the mock drafts say? I always enjoy analyzing things that aren't real. So let's analyze a mock draft.
That's why you like fantasy sports
exactly.
so much.
Exactly. It makes it easier for me. So are you... What are you seeing from the mock drafts? Running back? What do you think?
It seems like McCaffrey seems to be the one that people are picking. Former Governor Rendell, and former mayor of Philadelphia, Ed Rendell, was picking McCaffrey because he's a wide receiver and a running back. The Eagles have so many needs. I think an offensive player in the first round at 14, and then I think cornerbacks in rounds 2 and 3.
I'm going to ask you guys a question. If the draft wasn't in Philadelphia, would they trade the 14th pick?
No.
I don't think that had a say in it. I think that they just had a unique circumstance last year with Bradford and Minnesota wanting to make a push to get him. So I think it was just more a coincidence.
I'm interested to see what they do with the 14th pick, whether they go in the running back direction. Everybody says it's a deep running back and deep cornerback draft. Do you go with defensive line? They've signed some players.
Defense. If I were the Eagles, I'd go defensive back or I'd go defensive line.
There's definitely a lot of needs, and they're not always all going to be filled in the draft. Jeff, what's your feeling right now as we go into the draft with the offseason so far, with what they've done? They replaced Benny Logan with Jernigan. They signed Long to come off the end to replace Connor Barwin. They've got some wide receivers, so now they're 1 and 2, or basically they're 3 and 4 from last year. Do you feel more comfortable about where the Eagles are going into the draft than you did when the season ended?
Yes, very much. I think they did a good job in the offseason signing these players. I didn't think they had any money to do any of this, but they found some money somehow.
I still don't know how they're going to pay for everybody. Know. Ryan, what are your thoughts going into the draft?
Yeah, I'm more of a defensive first part, sort of, if I was the GM. But I think Dalvin Cook is also a really good option from Florida State. However, it just seems that given our lack of defense the last few years, that's where the needs are. So I would hope that they would cater towards that in the first few rounds. But in terms of the draft being in Philly, I noticed that they're going to take like a full week to take down the setup from the draft in the parkway. And they're expecting like 200,000 plus people. But again, I just don't think the draft is that worthy of making into an event where you have 200,000 people standing in the parkway waiting around for draft picks. Like, I just don't see how that's going to end well.
Well, I can't see Jeff Rupert going out and standing out there.
No,
Well, it'll be warmer.
But when I'm at the Eagles games at Lincoln Financial Field, I could walk around the stadium. There's all sorts of things to do.
You can walk around the parkway. There's going to be plenty of stuff to see.
I still live down there. And really, there isn't too much there.
You can go to the museum.
Oh, yeah.
It's right behind the stage.
It'll be off limits.
I understand people's complaints about it disrupting lives. I don't think it's ever bad to shine a spotlight on the city for national attention. And
I used to live there. I used to live at 17th and the Parkway.
So you wouldn't be very happy right now.
I would be. I didn't have the car back then. And you could walk everywhere, and I didn't have arthritis in my left knee, so I wasn't limping around. And it was great back then. I loved living down there.
You could sit by your window and watch the draft back then.
Yeah, that's right, with binoculars. Mm-hmm. When the Pope came, I had first row seats.
Well, maybe in order to annoy everyone, they'll trade down so that they can get more assets so that they too can follow the process.
Okay, Jeff said the magic word. He said assets, so it's time to talk Sixers. Their season mercifully ended. They lost, thankfully, their last game to New York by 1 point. Oh, my God, if they would have won and it cost us a draft pick spot. So the Sixers finished with the fourth worst record. The Lakers finished with the third worst record. Guys, I know that some of us had different hopes for the season. Jeff Rutberg, what are your thoughts right now?
It's an improvement, a big improvement. We didn't have to worry that they would set another record for futility. We saw some really good games, Embiid and Saric, and the hope is for Simmons.
Trust for the process.
Wait,
Jeff.
Did you hear what you just said?
What's that?
So you just said that they didn't set a record. So we've now lowered the bar so much that the Sixers. A good season is not setting a record for the worst season.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, to be clear,
the process.
Jeff Cohen is a little salty because he went and saw a game last week and it was not good basketball.
It was absolutely dreadful. They played the Bucks, and people were yelling at Brett Brown to take Poythress out, which when they would take him out, they'd put in somebody that was worse than him. And then they'd yell for him to go out. And you just got to wonder. I understand, you know, and Ryan's talked about how they drafted these guys with their potential knowing of their injuries. But if you draft so many guys that are injured, then this is what you get stuck with, is that their idea of being healthy is when the season's over, like the Sixers just announced yesterday, that guess what? Ben Simmons is finally healthy.
He's ready for the offseason.
What does that do for all the people that paid for tickets all season?
He's healthy for the offseason, Jeff. Let's look on the bright side here. 2 minutes left in the show. Let's go to the Phillies real fast. They put up 17 runs. I didn't think that I would see that from the Phillies. They also gave up almost 17 home runs to the Mets in the last couple games. They have given up so many home runs to the Mets in the last couple of years. It's astounding. Early thoughts of the season on the Phillies.
I was wrong about the bullpen.
Okay.
As evidenced by the fact that they've now replaced their closer, and I still think the ultimate closer will end up being Velasquez.
Well, I like Brock Stassi is getting some hits.
He had a home run,
so that's a good thing. The bullpen, Adam Morgan is already sent down, I think.
Yep, bye-bye. Yep.
Yep. Too bad.
Yeah, I think Neshek and Benoit really help a lot in the bullpen, and I just want to see the team play with a lot of heart. You know, the Mets coming to town and just winning 14 in the last 16 series here. I mean, hopefully the Phillies can just turn around and play hard every day.
Neshek's pitch makes my arm hurt. The angle and motion that he throws at. The offense has been better than I thought they would be so far. I'm not sure if they'll be able to keep that up, but it's been something that surprised me to start the season. The pitching is what we thought it was, I guess.
Well,
Buckles out now with the tear in his arm. That's never a good thing. Does it mean a younger arm comes up sooner from down on the farm?
I hope it's one of these young guys like Pivetta. Pivetta's only, I think, 22 years old. They got him from the Nationals in a trade a couple years ago. He's pretty good, and he played on the Canadian team, so he's gotten some experience against some better players during the World Baseball Classic.
That's going to be Jeff Cohen's last word. Jeff Rutberg, anything?
I'd like to see the Phillies continue to do well, and I'll get them off to all get there and watch.
We'll get down to a game. Ryan Strauss.
Can't wait for the NBA draft lottery in almost a month, and the Sixers are pretty primed to get two of the top five picks.
They're primed to get more assets. Thank you for joining us this week on The Heart of Sports. Make sure to join us at our new time and day next Saturday at 1 p.m. Thanks to everyone for listening, and we look forward to talking with you next week. Bye-bye.